Environment to order, and I'm going to open a pub. You can see, folks, we have quite an agenda. It looks worse than it is. But just for to help folks time manage, I'm carrying over the work session on House Bill 2236. Carrying over the House work session on House Bill 2269. And I'm carrying over the work session on 2710. Those will all appear on tomorrow's agenda, which will be an evening hearing.
I will not be here tomorrow.
We'll work on that later.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2404 and invite Representative Lively up and any other advocates that you want to have up there at the moment. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
Right ahead.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, and members of the committee, you can see a few empty seats, but I'll go with it. My name is John Lively. I'm a state representative from House District 12, which is in Springfield. I'm pleased to be before you today to talk about House Bill 2404 with a dash two amendments. Some of you know we've had this conversation previously talking about clean well water, and we're back with, we think, still a very good bill that can help address the issue. So this is really about public health and safety as it relates to contaminated drinking water, which many families may be faced with or without the knowledge needed to do anything about it. So that's the key thing we're talking about here, is the knowledge, having the knowledge to be able to do something about it if there is some contamination in water. We know it's substantial. I think the figure is more than 70% of substantial amount of Oregonians are reliant on well water for their source of drinking water. Many are in communities like mine, Springfield, which has all well water. But we have a utility company that monitors, makes all the investments, make sure we're meeting all the standards, and if we're not, if there's some risk, the standards changing those. And so we're in a fortunate position because that's taken care of for us, and we don't have to worry about it. But those that are on individual systems, and especially those that are tenants in rental facilities, in many cases, don't have that same opportunity. So those Oregonians who rely on well water as a primary source of drinking water deserve to know what is in that water and whether it's safe or not, and what risks they might be facing. So this bill, House Bill 2404 with the dash two amendments, does that allow, provides a mechanism in which the well water is tested. If there's not contaminants in it, there's a mechanism set up how often it has to be tested after that. But if there's nothing identified, it's not like they've got to keep testing. But if there's something identified, then follow-up tests have to be conducted until we either know for sure or not that that strain in the bacteria or what it might be in there has been identified. The other part, so it also adds to a program that already existed in OHA, SRs, regarding education on safe well water and what's available. So this complements that program there, so we're not having to recreate the wheel. And it also provides some opportunity for remediation or treatment if indeed something's identified in the well water that needs to be addressed. So I urge your consideration and support of a bill. I think that's a small step forward, but very important for those people that do rely upon well water for their drinking source. We have the experts here to be able to answer your questions.
Thank you.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Angela Crowley-Pick. I'm the legislative director for Oregon Environmental Council. We support House Bill 2404, and thank you to Representative Lively and also to Senator Roblin for all their work on this bill over the past few years. Since Representative Lively gave a great introduction, we have a couple experts following me. I'll just give a brief history of how this bill came to its current iteration. We introduced this bill. We worked with folks in 2015, and there were some concerns from a couple landlord organizations and tenant organizations who hadn't had a chance to weigh in on the new testing requirement for landlords. So I sat down with those folks in 2015 and 2016. We came to an agreement and then learned that the Farm Bureau had some concerns. So I sat down with them over the last year and have worked out an agreement with them as well. So I have permission from these groups to say on the record that the Farm Bureau has been working with us and they are neutral on the bill. There are several landlord organizations, their names are very similar, so I get them confused. But one of them is supportive and the other is neutral. So we've all been working together to make sure the bill is in a good place for everyone. So the agreement that was reached was that, as Representative Lively mentioned, the tests, if there is no presence of either bacteria or nitrates for 3 consecutive years, then landlords can switch to a 5-year testing schedule. And the results can be given in a pass-fail format if the landlord chooses. And so that's the agreement we've come to. I think it's a great bill. We all worked well together and happy to answer any questions.
Committee, any questions for this? For Representative Lively in this panel. Thank you very much. And I'll call up Mr. High and Bill Eminger and Amy Patton. And welcome. We really appreciate you being here today. Because of the very packed schedule I have, though, I'd very much appreciate if we could keep your comments to about 2 minutes.
Okay.
So I know you probably have more to say, but give us the high points.
Mm-hmm. We'll do that. Chair Helm and members of the committee, I am Jerry High, administrator of the Center for Health Protection from the Public Health Division within the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here to provide information on how this bill would impact services provided by the OHA Domestic Well Safety Program. So the implementation of this bill would greatly expand OHA's scope of work on domestic wells. Currently, the federal funded domestic well program supports about 1.25 FTE, and they provide maintenance and analysis of data related to the ORS involved. The Domestic Well Testing Act. Long-term funding for this domestic well program is uncertain, with current federal funding for the program lasting only through September of 2020. So this bill makes a number of changes to the well program and to the requirements related to the domestic wells in Oregon. It would require us to analyze real estate transaction well testing data collected under the existing program to identify groundwater contaminant areas and to provide education in these areas. And we would also be required to continue these activities indefinitely regardless of funding ability. Second, the bill as introduced sets requirements for landlords whose tenants obtain drinking water from wells on their property to test wells at specified intervals for arsenic, nitrates, and total coliform bacteria. We wish to note in 2016, the Environmental Protection Agency amended the total coliform rule for drinking water and replaced it instead with total coliform bacteria with testing for E. coli. So that statute should similarly be updated to specify testing for E. coli rather than the current reference to total chloroform. The proposed Dash 1 amendment requires laboratories to electronically submit landlord test results to EQ, and we believe that will increase submission compliance compared to the current compliance rate for the existing real estate transfer testing reporting, which is, we estimate from our partners, is about 25% of the real estate transactions. Thirdly, it establishes the Safe Groundwater Fund that would permit the domestic well program to provide grants to the local public health authorities, nonprofit organizations, soil and water conservation. At its current capacity, the well program would not be able to manage additional grant awards. However, we would welcome resources to provide additional grant opportunities to these local organizations. And then finally, as introduced, it directs OHA to provide information to property owners on how to install treatment systems and how to repair or replace a well. We currently don't have staff resources necessary to provide individual consultation on those repairs, replacement, or treatment options. But as an alternative, we can make general information on these topics available on our website, including a recommendation to property owners that they look for specific third-party certification of treatment units. There's some more details in the submitted testimony, but I abbreviated that I'm at your request.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Okay. Let's finish up this panel, and then we'll, if there are questions, we'll ask them then. Whoever's ready next.
Good afternoon, Representative Helm and members of the House Committee on Energy and Environment. My name is Bill Eminger. I'm the Environmental Health Director for Benton County Health Department. We, from 2014 to 2016, got a small grant from Oregon Health Authority to go out and work with private homeowners and do testing of wells. And one of the outcomes of that is we found a surprising number of homeowners had never tested their wells before. During that process, we identified 18% of the wells had positives for coliforms, 21% had some level of arsenic, 28% had some level of nitrate, and over 12% had more than one of the contaminants, so they might have had two contaminants. Now, why is that important? Well, for us, it's important because testing for coliforms and E. coli are indicator organisms for potential human pathogens that might have gotten into the water supply. That could be everything from norovirus to salmonella to shigella. It could be field contamination that got into the well. Arsenic is a long-term consumption of water with arsenic above the drinking water standard may increase health risk for some problems such as skin, circulatory systems, nervous systems, lung, and bladder. And these health concerns also include some forms of cancer. And then regarding nitrate, nitrate levels above 10 parts per million present a serious health concern for infants and pregnant or nursing women. This is especially true for bottle-fed infants whose formula is reconstituted with drinking water with high nitrate concentration. Pregnant women may be less able to tolerate nitrate. Nitrate in the milk of nursing mothers also may affect infants directly. Some of the conditions that also may occur is spontaneous miscarriages, thyroid disorders, birth defects, development of some cancers in adults. Recent human epidemiological studies have also shown that nitrate ingestion may be linked to gastric or bladder cancers. In one woman that we talked to, she also indicated she had four miscarriages before she found out that she had elevated nitrates in her drinking water. So if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you for your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairman Helm and members of the committee. I'm Amy Patton. I'm a private consultant down in Southern Oregon. I've been working in water quality field as a hydrogeologist for about 30 years. Most recently, I have been working in public education for private well owners, and I've been conducting a number of free nitrate test events that are targeted to areas of Jackson and Josephine County where we are aware that there are elevated nitrate levels. And we've conducted about 750 of these tests. A couple years ago, during one of these events, for one thing, we find regularly about 20% of the wells that we test have elevated nitrates. And we test for nitrate because it's a simple, inexpensive test to indicate that there's some contamination coming from ground sources into the drinking water. DEQ has recently done other work in the valley that's shown a connection between nitrate and bacteria, and also nitrate and some pesticides at low levels. So recently, about 4 to 5% of the wells have had nitrate above the drinking water standard. What's disturbed me the most during these events is when I have to tell the well owners when they come to get their water results, you have extremely high nitrate in your water and you should stop drinking that water. And particularly when those are families with young children, and that happens. Last year, I had a situation where I had a family with an infant come, and their results were off the charts. They were higher than our testing could test. And when I informed them of their results, they said, "Oh, is this why my baby's lips were turning blue and fingertips were turning blue?" Blue baby syndrome is the primary concern of elevated nitrate, and infants can die of that situation because it impedes the oxygen getting through the blood. And as it turns out, this woman's infant had very low birth rate, had a normal birth weight, but then succeeded in going down to the 5% growth rate during his first year, until she learned that her nitrates were elevated and she stopped feeding him formula made from their well water, and now he's back up at a 20% birth weight or growth rate. And that was a very scary situation where they really, you know, and they don't even know yet if the child has had further impacts besides just the growth rate and a temporary blue lips and fingertips.
Amy, thanks for that. I'm going to ask you if you could wrap up.
Okay. I feel this is a really important bill. There are a lot of people in rural areas that I have spoken to personally who are not aware of their water quality, and particularly people who are renting who were not informed of any water quality issue at the time of their lease.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Representative Holvey has a very quick question.
Thank you. I'm just curious about this fund. If it's determined that the nitrates or coliform or whatever is a result of a non-functioning septic tank system in the immediate vicinity, could this loan or fund be used to fix that treatment system?
My understanding is that is one of the... No, it is not. Okay, OEC is shaking their head.
Yeah, I think it's primarily, the way I read it, it's concentrated, Chair and Representative Hovely, it's represented for the water system, although that could be an effective treatment, but I don't think the bill currently covers that.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much for being here today. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you very much.
And this bill isn't quite ready to work, so I'm going to close the public hearing, and we'll have a work session later in the week. And I'm going to, at this time, I'll go ahead and carry over the work session on House Bill 2404 until to tomorrow's agenda. In committee, I would like to go ahead and hold the work session on House Bill 3166. At this time, I'm opening a work session on House Bill 3166. Beth, can you give us a rundown on this?
Mr. Chair and committee members, you originally heard this bill on 4-3. There's a dash to amendment available on OLIS that replaces the measure. It modifies the cost recovery formula for site certificate holders by removing limitation that no more than 35% of annual fee be for recovery of general costs, and requires the Department of Energy director to adopt a formula for apportioning general costs among holders of site certificates, changes the calculated share of the annual energy resource supplier assessment, below which energy resource supplier is exempt from paying the assessment, from $250 to $2,500, establishes the 9-member FSEC, or Energy Facility Siting Task Force, and transfers duties, functions, and powers from the Oregon Department of Energy related to the issuance of loans for small-scale energy loan projects to the Oregon Business Development Department. There is a revenue impact issued and a fiscal impact issued on the bill.
I entertain a motion on this bill.
Chair Helm, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated March 29, 2017.
Representative Power moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 3/29/2017. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Helm, I move House Bill 3166 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Power moves House Bill 3166 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was hoping that, you know, if there's no objection, I was looking at the nine-member board, and I guess I was assuming that some of those members would be from energy suppliers. I know it does read that, about the stakeholders, but I think at least two of those members should be from energy suppliers, and hopefully, you know, we might be able to make that small tweak further on down the road, but I'll be supporting the bill as is right now.
Okay. Thank you. Further, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be a no today. I think this bill still needs a little more work, and I'd rather see that taken care of before we pass it out of committee.
Any further discussion? Okay. Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
No.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Reschke?
No.
Representative Brocksmith?
No.
Vice Chair Johnson?
No.
Vice Chair
Power?
Aye.
Chair
Hill? Aye. The motion passes and the bill will be sent to as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. I'm now going to open a work session on House Bill 2111.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2111, there's a dash one amendment. The bill itself prohibits the inclusion of provisions in any declaration or bylaws of a planned community that prevent an owner from installing or using solar panels and allows the owner subject to such provisions to petition for the removal of the provision. There's a dash one amendment that authorizes homeowners association to adopt and enforce provision that imposes reasonable size, placement, or aesthetic requirements for installation or use of the solar panels. There's a no revenue and no fiscal impact statement on the measure.
Okay, thank you. I'd entertain a motion on this bill.
Chair Helm, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated March 3rd, 2017. April 3rd, 2017.
April 3rd, 2017. Okay. Representative Power moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated April 3, 2017. Is there any discussion? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, we did add some clarifying language that I think provides a little more context for HOAs going forward that I think will be helpful to them. So I thank Rep. Greenlee for his indulgence and waiting for us to get those changes made. So I appreciate it.
Very good. Any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Chair Helm, I move House Bill 2111 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Power moves House Bill 2111 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Colby?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Reschke?
Aye.
Representative Brocksmith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Power?
Aye.
Chair Helm?
Aye. The motion passes, and we'll need a carrier for this bill. Representative
Greenlick? Be my suggestion.
Thank you. And I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2111. And I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2681.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2681, you originally heard on 329. It extends the sunset of tax credits for the construction or installation of residential alternative energy devices from 2018 to 2024. The Dash 1 amendment available on OLIS requires ODO to take steps to ensure that the use of the tax credit addresses rising costs of fossil fuels, need for energy conservation, and economic feasibility of alternative forms of energy, promotes energy savings or energy displacement and transformation facilities, taxpayer actions that would not be taken if the tax credit was not available. Taxpayers applying are from varying demographics, and the use coordinates with the use of other incentives. It requires ODO to report on the operation of the tax credit to the Legislative Assembly, to the Committee on Revenue, by March 31st of each odd number year. And there's a revenue and fiscal impact issued on the measure.
The committee, there is a Dash 1 amendment that I assume that you've seen that places some sideboards on how we assess and evaluate the RETC. And if Max Miller is here, if we have questions for him, I can ask him forward. If not, I'm going to go ahead and move this along. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just simply note that the addition of the amendment will make this one work a lot better than I think it has in the past. Referral to a subsequent referral to tax credits is the right one.
Yes. Great. Any other questions that Mr. Miller might? Okay. Very good. Then I'm going to ask for a motion on this bill.
Chair Helm, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated April 4th, 2017.
Representative Power moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated April 4, 2017. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the amendment? Oh, Representative Holder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just a little concerned about the fiscal impact potentially of this bill, and that we don't have any sort of cap on the bill. And I know that the governor's office had recommended ending this sunset, until we got a chance to, get some good parameters on it. I appreciate the. What's happened with the bill so far, but I'm still concerned about that long-term impact to our general fund on this.
Okay. Any further discussion on the amendment? Okay. Shall I call the roll? Any objection to the amendment? Mm. Okay. Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Chair Helm, I move House Bill 2681 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Representative Power moves House Bill 2681 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can support moving the bill down to JTAX because I do think that's the proper place to have the conversation. But I do think we need continue, as I think Representative Holdley mentioned, we need a comprehensive discussion about the funding, about the sideboards, but particularly about, just who the state is providing incentives to. And I would continue to hold to the opinion that I don't think folks in Lake Oswego need to have the state helping them provide solar panels on their homes when we can't afford school teachers in the state. So that would be my position.
Poor Lake Oswego.
Yeah.
You should beat up on my district once in a while, maybe.
Beaverton, I'll throw them in there, too.
Any further? Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just add to the list of considerations once it gets to the tax credit committee, the issue of transferability, which now exists within the tax credit, that might be something that we should look at to make sure that it's really directly benefiting the people we want it to benefit.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Vence?
Aye.
Representative Holby?
It will be a courtesy yes.
Representative Marsh?
Yes.
Aye.
Representative Rocksmith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Powers?
Aye.
Aye. The motion passes. And the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Tax Credits. I'm opening a work session now on House Bill 2343.
Mr. Chair and committee members, you originally heard House Bill 2343 on 215. The measure itself replaces a requirement for the State Department of Energy to complete a biennial comprehensive energy plan and a biennial energy forecast with a requirement for the department to complete a biennial comprehensive energy report. It requires a report to be transmitted to the governor of the legislature no later than November 1st of every even-numbered year. There's a dash 3 amendment on OLIS that changes the title of the existing Oregon Department of Energy Comprehensive Plan to Oregon Department to Comprehensive Energy Report. There's also a dash 5 amendment that removes the express rulemaking authority, clarifies the act is not intended to allow disclosure of records exempt under inspection of public records statute, requires the Department of Energy to establish procedures for certain things. There's a no revenue impact and a no fiscal impact on the dash 5 amendment.
Okay. Thank you. Is there a discussion on this bill before I...
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2343.
Okay. So Representative Johnson moves to adopt the dash 3 amendments. I don't remember the date of the bill. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I think these amendments help keep the department focused on, which I think is their primary role, which is reporting rather than planning and policy creation, especially as we're still trying to determine the ultimate function and outcome for the department. I think this is a good amendment that keeps them, again, focused on productive work that's a benefit to our utilities and energy suppliers in the state.
Further discussion? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be opposing the dash 3 amendment. I think it falls a little bit short of really providing the direction and actually the information for the department to accomplish the mission of the department, even the current mission. And as I recall, many of the troubles the Department of Energy has had over the past is they didn't have the information, resources, or access to it to actually accomplish their mission. So I don't see the dash 3 amendment as helping that, and we'll be supporting a different amendment. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll for the vote on this amendment, please?
Representative Barnhart?
We're voting on the dash 3?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm a no.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Holby?
No.
Representative Marsh?
No.
Representative Rushke?
Aye.
Representative Ross Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Johnson?
Aye.
Vice
Chair Power?
No.
Chair Helm? No. The motion to adopt the dash 3 amendment fails. Now I would welcome a motion on this bill.
Chair Helm, I move to adopt the dash 5 amendment dated March 21st, 2017.
Representative Power moves to adopt the dash 5 amendment dated March 21, 2017. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the amendment? I imagine there would be. So an objection is noted. Would the clerk please call the roll on the dash 5 amendment?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
No.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Rushke?
No.
Representative
Rocksmith?
No.
Vice Chair Johnson?
No.
Vice Chair Howard?
Aye.
Chair Helm?
Aye. The amendment is adopted.
Chair Helm, I moved House Bill 2343 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Power moves House Bill 2343 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative
Barnhart?
Aye. Representative Benz?
No.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Rocksmith?
No.
Vice Chair Johnson?
No.
Vice Chair Howard?
Aye.
Chair Helm?
Aye. The motion passes. And you will need a carrier for this bill, and as a welcome present to our new, probably temporary member, I'll ask Representative Marsh to carry. And I was remiss in not welcoming you earlier at the beginning of the meeting, but you're very welcome on this committee, and we appreciate your expertise and hard work. This time I'm going to open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3025.
Mr. Chair and committee member, House Bill 3025 would exclude certain battery charger systems from the definition of battery charger system for purposes of energy efficiency standards. There's a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact issue on this measure.
Thank you. And with that, I'll invite up Walter Alcorn.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am Walter Alcorn with the Consumer Technology Association, and I'll be very brief. You have in front of you, I believe, letters from both CTA and also ITI. This bill would fix a problem that was inadvertently created when California several years ago adopted energy efficiency standards for battery chargers and captured these small embedded energy chargers. This standard was then picked up and implemented here in Oregon. And since then, California has corrected the problem, but it still needs to be corrected here. We first looked to see if it could be corrected by rule. Unfortunately, this requires a statutory amendment. Thus, we would encourage you to move forward with us and approve this bill. So thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Any questions from the committee? Very good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here today. And with that, I think I opened a work session, did I not? Okay. With that, I'll entertain a motion on this bill.
Chair Hum, I move House Bill 3025 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Power moves House Bill 3025 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Just briefly.
Representative Johnson.
I remember when we first took this topic up, I think 4 years ago, and we revised our code and made the determination to follow California, but I guess I would just, for the record, like to point out that it's not always a wise move to follow California as we are talking about creating energy policy, so I'll just let that stand for itself. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. See, no further discussion. Will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative
Benz?
Aye.
Representative
Colby?
Aye.
Representative
Marsh? Aye.
Representative
Brockman? Aye. Vice Chair Johnson? Aye. Vice Chair Power? Aye. Chair Hall? Aye. The motion passes. And we need a carrier there. Representative Power, would you carry this?
Sure.
Thank you. This time, I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2471. Okay. So, welcome.
Thank you.
We've had this on the agenda a couple of times, and I'm glad that we're finally able to hear this. Do we allocate time for this? We're pressed. We may be pressed for time, but
okay.
Maybe
sure.
About if we could get this done in 20 minutes with questions, that might be nice. Although, let's see. Actually,
I can do less.
Okay.
Okay.
I've got several folks signed up to speak about the bill, too, so, yeah, 15 minutes would be wonderful.
Doable. Okay, thank you. Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, Tracy Rutten with League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 2471 and the proposed Dash 1 amendments. The League introduced this legislation, and we thank Representative Benz and Representative Boone for their sponsorship of this bill. To be very honest, I've struggled a little bit with this legislation in trying to reconcile whether I think this is a technical fix or whether I think this is more of a substantial policy discussion. And really where I've landed is I think it's a little bit of both. And I think it's a discussion that needs to happen. So I really do appreciate the time today to hear this bill. The bill with the Dash 1 amendments preserves the ability for cities to form consumer-owned municipal electric utilities in the future. Recent changes to the Renewable Portfolio Standard have highlighted requirements that LOC believes would make future formation of such utilities cost prohibitive. I have Chad Stokes, an attorney with Cable Houston, here today to help answer any questions, as he has worked on municipal electric utility formations in Oregon, and as he can answer questions, being that this is a rather complex issue. And I do have a PowerPoint presentation, but I will promise to be as brief as I can. Technology is not usually my favorite. So just as a little background, there are currently 12 municipal electric utilities that exist in Oregon. The majority of them serve a population that is quite small in comparison, especially to the two largest investor-owned utilities that exist in Oregon, which I'm sure you are already aware of, is PGE and Pacific Power. These municipal electric utilities provide safe, reliable electricity to their customers, and they receive most of their electricity from Tier 1 hydropower that is provided through Bonneville Power Administration. The typical portfolio for most of the existing municipal electric utilities includes approximately 90% or more of BPA hydropower. So a considerable amount of electricity that they acquire is from that BPA hydropower that's set aside for the purpose of these types of formations. And just to clarify, as we talk through this, municipal electric utilities are a type of consumer-owned utility, so you can use those terms interchangeably, just to clarify. So today, the issue that we are talking about is how Oregon's Renewable Portfolio Standard applies to these types of utilities. Oregon's RPS standard requires that, as you know, specific percentage of electricity in a utility's portfolio comes from what are known as qualifying renewables. When the RPS standard was initially adopted in 2007, the requirements for that acquisition of a specific percentage of qualifying renewables varied based on the size of the utility or on essentially what was the number of retail customers served. As you can see in the slide, there are separate phased-in requirements for utilities that make sales of less than 3% of all electricity sold to retail consumers. These are what are known as the small electric utilities. A large utility is going to be over that 3% number. However, you'll see that there's language at the bottom of the slide that talks about an exemption and indicates that the exemption that exists, so the exemption that says you are a small electric utility and your requirements are different, terminates if a consumer-owned utility acquires service territory of an investor-owned utility without their consent. And what that means is that regardless of the size or total number of customers that they serve, the small utility would be subject to the same RPS requirements as a large investor-owned utility in Oregon. Let's see here. So, see if I did that right. Okay. So applying that large utility RPS requirement to a small consumer-owned electric utility would, as you would imagine, likely be cost prohibitive. Again, we're talking about some very small utilities. City of Drain, for instance, is one of our existing municipal electric utilities. Certainly a very small population that they are serving. However, there was a critical exemption that was included in the 2000 RPS bill that was passed that addressed this policy challenge. And thus, it preserved the ability for the future formation of consumer-owned and municipal electric utilities. That exemption indicated that a newly formed consumer-owned utility would not be required to meet the large utility RPS number to the extent it would require them to reduce available BPA hydro or Tier 1 preferred power from the Bonneville Power Administration. This is power that's been, again, specifically set aside for the purpose of this type of formation. And I also want to note that it's hydropower that we share with the state of Washington. So I think a policy consideration is that if we don't want to use this hydropower, I have a feeling that our neighbors up north would probably be more than happy to do so. So really, the practical application of what this exemption language did. So if a city were to decide to form a new municipal electric utility, and there was not consent to do so from the investor-owned utility, they would no longer be considered a small electric utility under the RPS requirement. Therefore, they'd be subject to the same RPS number as a large investor-owned utility. And however, as most of the municipal electric utilities are able to acquire about 90% plus, give or take, other electric needs through BPA Hydro, the exemption really does provide them with this critical path forward to be able to continue to use that hydropower, and essentially provides them a path that allows them to form that is not going to be cost prohibitive for them to do so. So, for example, City X. If City X forms a new electric utility, and let's say we're going to use very round numbers, they need 10 megawatts of electricity. And they can obtain, let's say, 95% of their electricity from that BPA hydro, so 9.5 megawatts. Then that means that the City X, because of the exemption language, would not need to reduce that 95% number down in order to make room for that RPS number. And so that's pretty much how the exemption plays out for us. Now what we would be required to do is fill the remainder with qualifying renewables. That would be 5% for this scenario. And I'm going to skip ahead. Just in the effort to save some time. So essentially, there was legislation, as I'm sure a lot of you are aware, in 2016 that made some significant changes to the Oregon Renewable Portfolio Standard. One of the changes in there was on this notion of the exemption that we currently or have in the past had on in terms of how we're treated under the RPS and whether or not we would need to reduce available BPA hydro in order to make room for that RPS number. The exemption that prevents consumer-owned municipal electric utilities from having to reduce that hydropower would have been removed under House Bill 4036. That would mean that regardless of their size, a consumer-owned utility would have an RPS requirement of up to 50%, which is a fairly sizable number for a smaller electric utility. We believe that this would have had the impact of making such formations incredibly cost-prohibitive. If not impossible. And again, these utilities do not serve a large population, and they just don't have the rate base to be able to operate under the same requirements as a large investor-owned utility. Fortunately, at the end of the 16 legislative session, there was, as you know, 4036 became Senate Bill 1547, and the exemption for the BPA hydropower was restored, according to our understanding of the bill. However, there was a provision that remained that would require a newly formed consumer-owned utility, if they were formed again without consent from the investor-owned utility, to meet the large utility RPS by the beginning of the calendar year following acquisition or formation. The practical impact of this timeline is that it makes the exemption pretty much unusable, in our opinion. The reason for this is that BPA has a wait period of 3 years to access Tier 1 hydropower. If the formation of the utility appeared on a November ballot, as most of these formations are going to appear on a ballot, then that means the utility would need to come up with up to 50% qualifying renewables by January 1. So that is about a 60-day window to acquire up to 50% renewables. So we are obviously concerned. I'll kind of try and come to a close without getting too much further in the weeds. We are concerned about the notion of the language that indicates by the beginning of the calendar year. What the bill does that's before you today is it provides us with 10 years to come up with, well, basically it lets us acquire the BPA hydro that we're allowed to access that's currently been set aside for this type of formation. Right now there's been actually 250 megawatts set aside. It's now 210 because we had a PUD form up in Washington that's now used 40 megawatts of that. So it's limited number of power. We're not talking about a lot of formation here. And again, I want to note that in terms of municipal electric utility formation, it is not an easy effort. I do not think that any passage of any legislation is going to suddenly have people racing, coming forward wanting to do this. It's a very complex process. It's very time consuming. But we want to preserve that power. And we think there's a significant policy question position here, which is, you know, essentially what we left with was we were left with legislation that was kind of hurry up and buy a lot of RECs, you know, renewable energy certificates. What is the appropriate window? What is the appropriate timeline? And that's the conversation we're hoping to have in that House Bill 2471 would address. I'll also note that there is a Dash 1 amendment, and that also clarifies that the ask the PUC to use the FERC methodology when they're calculating stranded cost. That was another issue that came up in the 2016 legislation. It currently does not ask for any specific methodology to be used, and we're not sure what PUC would use in determining stranded costs. So we'd like to see there be some clarification on that issue. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, and hopefully that was not 20 minutes.
No.
Okay.
Considerably less.
A lot to cover.
Questions?
Ms. Panel.
Representative Johnson.
Thanks, Chair. So, Tracy, when was the last municipal acquisition that you could potentially be referring to here? It doesn't seem like we hear about them popping up very frequently, right?
Chair Helm and Vice Chair Johnson, we're going to see if I get this right. I believe it was 2001 was the last
in Oregon
formation.
The City of Hermiston.
City of Hermiston, which I think was in 2001. So, yes, I can double-check that information, but you are correct. This is not something that happens frequently. Again, we only have 12 total in Oregon. So, again, it's not a process that our cities, and that's why you're not going to see a lot of cities running up here today to testify either. I'm not aware of any of them that want to wave that flag around and say, sure, we're considering this. I'm not aware of any that are currently considering this, but we'd like to preserve that option going forward.
Very good. And Mr. Stokes, can I have you add your name for our record?
Yes, my name is Chad Stokes from the Cable Houston Law Firm.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And to testify on the bill, Elizabeth Howe, John Powell, Ricky Sanguin, and Rhett Lawrence. We might need to get another. And go right ahead, whoever's ready first.
Okay,
jump
sure.
Right in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Howe. I'm here representing Pacific Power. Pacific Power serves 560,000 customers in Oregon. We're Oregon's largest rural electricity provider, and we own assets in 31 of 36 counties. We are here to oppose House Bill 2471. House Bill 2471 on its face appears to create a 10-year delay in implementing RPS requirements. However, we really view it as a loophole. To explain that a little better, let me provide some background. Senate Bill 838 from 2007 established the Oregon RPS, and it was a careful balance among stakeholders. An important feature was the compromise between public sector and private sector utilities. Large utilities have a 25% at the time, had a 25% obligation, and smaller utilities had a 5 or 10% obligation, depending on the size of that utility. So because of the difference, there was a compromise negotiated that protected large utilities from a competitive disadvantage by smaller utilities that could use their condemnation authority to acquire service territory. That provision basically required the entire utility system making the acquisition to meet the same RPS obligation as the utility system it would acquire through a hostile takeover over a specified ramp-in period. In return, private sector utilities agreed that the lowest cost preference power supplied by the Bonneville Power Administration to public power utilities would not be required to be displaced as part of the new RPS. After that time, BPA implemented its tiered rate structure, which created what we know today as Tier 1 power. The changes BPA implemented caused the service territory compromise to become conflicted. The way new public power customers would acquire their Tier 1 power could be interpreted to create a loophole that would render the RPS obligation moot. While this conflict was unintentional, it produced considerable uncertainty. So in House Bill, sorry, I just got a note that I'm supposed to speed up. Okay. So in 1547, we fixed the loophole. So the year following a new municipalization formation, they would be required to comply with the RPS of the service territory they're acquiring. I'll stop.
Okay. Maybe somebody else can finish up what you...
I had most of it.
Good. So okay.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Portland General Electric. And we would just echo the testimony of Ms. Howe and note our opposition to House Bill 2471. In the interest of time, I will just touch on the Dash 1 Amendment and our opposition to that. The Dash 1 Amendment deals with stranded costs obligations, which basically are when a municipal utility acquires, generally through eminent domain, service territory, or property of an electric company. Current law holds that at the request of the PUC, the PUC shall establish a stranded costs obligation. On page 1, line 16 of the Dash 1 Amendment, it is suggested to change the shall to a may, which again suggests that when a municipal utility using eminent domain acquires customer service territory and property of an electric company, there may not be any costs associated with that to the remaining electric company's customers. We would take issue with that and strongly believe that there would be some kind of costs and that it should be left to the PUC to do that analysis and develop the methodology to develop those costs. So, in conclusion, stranded cost obligations have been a bedrock regulatory principle that an acquiring utility should bear the cost of paying off the assets rather than having those costs involuntarily shifted to the remaining customers of the electric company. With that, I will conclude my testimony.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, Ricky Seguin. I work as the policy director with Renewable Northwest. We're a regional renewable energy advocacy organization, and our members consist of developers as well as consumer advocates and environmental nonprofits. And I'm here today in opposition to House Bill 2471, as well as the Dash 1 amendments. And I will focus my testimony on sort of the high-level points. But the primary reason that we're here in opposition is we see House Bill 2471 directly undermine the renewable portfolio standard, both in its original form and the increased version that we passed last session. Senate Bill 1547 last year, passing that was a historic moment for Oregon, capturing the will of the people to transition to a clean energy resource mix. And while it's difficult to talk about this bill because, for me, you're talking about these one utility acquiring service territory of another utility without the permission of the latter utility, I will try to get through the jumbled words, forgive me. Much like with direct access customers who choose to acquire power separate from the utility, by leaving, they are not allowed to abandon the utility's renewable portfolio standards. We should not have customers choosing to leave a utility service territory because of the state's goals and commitments to clean energy. I wanted to point out, and Janice Thompson from CUB wasn't able to make today's hearing on this, but did submit testimony online. I would echo the points that Janice made in her submitted testimony regarding the concerns around the Dash 1 amendment, stranded cost obligation, and the PUC's ability to determine what stranded costs look like, and challenges with requiring the FERC requirements for determining that. So I just wanted to point that out to you because I know she couldn't be here today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Rhett Lawrence. I'm the conservation director for the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club. I'll be very brief. I will direct you to the written testimony in OLIS submitted by Amy Hodgenowski, senior campaign representative for the Beyond Coal campaign of the Sierra Club. I just wanted to briefly weigh in, also in opposition to House Bill 2471. It's our belief that this measure is counter to what was contemplated by the agreements around the clean electricity and coal transition bill from last session, and we would agree with the comments from Renewable Northwest that this is an undermining of the renewable portfolio standard in our state, and we would not want to be taking that backward step. So I'll just leave it at that, and thank you for taking our testimony.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Johnson, and then Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It could be for either one of you, but related to the Hermiston situation back in 03, did we hear? Was that the last one that occurred, I think? The last acquisition? Did the PUC go through a process of determining stranded costs at that point? Do we know what that looks like? I'm just curious. Maybe we'd have to call her former expert back up, but I guess it's just hard to quantify, I guess, what that would look like and what factors would go into determining what that stranded cost would be.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I don't have any specifics, especially about Hermiston specifically, but I know the general idea of stranded cost is that when we make investments in an area, whether it's transmission or a substation, it's to meet certain load requirements of serving that area. And so if that load is then being served by somebody else, our customers receive some compensation back for those investments that were made. So that's the general idea of stranded costs, or being compensated back for them. Yeah.
I agree totally, but I would say going forward, I think we need to be sensitive to, as the state might put on additional cost-driving burdens, let's say via policy on utilities that you have to comply with, those also would somehow have to be factored in there as well, too. The 50% mandate will involve some costs, we know that, but it becomes a very complicated scenario, I guess, is what I'm saying, and it would be, I have no idea what kind of formula the PUC would use in trying to determine what a fair stranded cost would look like. So that's not an easy ask, I guess, is what I'm saying at the PUC.
Chair Helm, Representative Johnson, if I could add to that, the concept with stranded costs, the key word that you just said that is very important is fair. As we are setting forward goals and policies that put our state on a track toward clean energy, utility is planning 20, 30 years in advance for that diversification of their fuel mix. And so as those investments are made, if a customer were to choose to leave through something like direct access, or if a new utility formed, or if a large load were to leave to go to a different utility, investments were made on their behalf. And so the stranded cost obligation is a matter of figuring out how do we ensure that the utility isn't eating the cost that they made because of the requirements that we set.
Sounds like a good endorsement for stable, predictable energy policy. Thanks.
Representative Bent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I co-sponsored this bill because it appeared to me that the folks who are benefited by it were not at the table when 1547 was negotiating, and it seemed to me that there had been some dramatic overreaching by those who were. It also seems to me that it's odd that I would see environmental interests supporting the RPS, when in point of fact the power that the smaller groups have is hydro, seems odd. My question, though, is this. When the folks emerged from the back room with 1547 in hand, without having given these smaller folks the opportunity to participate, somehow the 1547 contained 60 days within which these small groups were to comply with the RPS. 60 days. Now, will one of you tell me that that's a reasonable amount of time within which to comply? And while you're doing it, explain to me why any one of us would suggest that we should stand in the road of competition, which is the whole idea, to have a number of different utilities, not just two great big ones. So there's a bunch of questions. Pick one, answer it. But the one that I really am interested in is the 60 days. Tell me why that's fair, why that's rational, why you think if they'd been at the table, they would have agreed to such a thing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I don't know that I have an answer for you, specifically because I think the bill says the following year, so I think that makes an assumption that there's an election 60 days before the beginning of that year, but they could do it earlier in the year, I suppose. A May election?
If I follow up. Yeah, I think it would have been helpful if they'd been at the table so they could have actually debated and negotiated that exact point. But the elections are generally held in November, and this bill says in the following January, that's even less than 60 days. Mm-hmm. So what I'm just saying is, would you think that anybody could comply with such a standard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I suppose it would depend on how big the utility is, how well-financed the city is, and what the market rate for renewable power would be at the time of utility formation. So otherwise, I'm not sure.
Thank you.
Any more questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you very much for testifying today.
Thank you.
And with that, those are the only individuals that are signed up to testify on that bill. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2471. And I'm going to carry over the work session on House Bill 2471 to tomorrow's agenda. And I don't see them here yet. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3202. And invite up Andy Shaw and Bernie Bottingley. There's Bernie. There's Andy. Okay. Welcome, and
thank you for having us.
Go ahead as soon as you're ready.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, Bernie Bottomley with TriMet. I think we can be fairly quick and efficient about our presentation, which is what the bill is actually about, being quick and efficient. What's before you is legislation that actually in largely the same form has passed the legislature twice before, the first time in the early 80s and the second time in the 90s. It's a piece of legislation that facilitates the land use decisions that allow for the location of a light rail project that crosses multiple jurisdictional lines. And the reason that's important, as you can imagine, each local jurisdiction typically has their own independent land use review structure. And when you're doing a light rail line, you want there to be consistency in how that line expresses itself on the landscape. So you want, for example, the same height restrictions, the same width restrictions, the same gauge of track, those kinds of things, obviously. And so this legislation helps to make more uniform the land use criteria that's used for evaluating the siting of the rail project and the ancillary facilities. And ancillary facilities includes things like stations and the utility structures and so forth that are necessary to support the project. So primarily this is to create uniformity in the criteria that are used to evaluate the siting of a project. And as I mentioned, we had similar legislation for the West Side Light Rail project, and then later for what very few of you will probably recall was called the South North project, which was a light rail project that was planned from Oregon City to Vancouver, Washington. The legislation encompassed that entire corridor, and so all of the projects that have been done in that corridor since then, the I-205 line, the yellow line up to Northeast Portland, and most recently the orange line to Milwaukee, all fell within that geographic boundary. So we haven't needed to come back and revisit this legislation for quite some time. We're now looking at what's called the Southwest Corridor Project, which is between Portland and Tigard and Tualatin, out the Barber I-5 corridor. And the geography of the old South-North legislation no longer encompasses this project. So each of these pieces of legislation have been geographically bounded, so they only apply in the corridor where the rail project is being contemplated. And so we're coming back with an amended piece of legislation that one of the things that it does is redefine the corridor and establish the Southwest Corridor as having this modified land use process as part of it. The other thing that this legislation does is it gives us a streamlined and time-bound appeals process for appeals associated with the land use final order for a light rail project. And the reason that's important is that these projects depend on receiving federal funding. The federal government, for most of the projects that we've done, has funded at least 50% or more of the cost. One of the critical issues that they need to see in our application is that we have all of the land use approvals in place for the project. And as you probably know, in Oregon's system, being able to represent that you have a final decision on a land use decision is can be problematic because there are lots of opportunities to revisit questions in the process. So this legislation provides a more streamlined set of appeals. For example, there's basically one round of appeals each time rather than multiple rounds. And instead of going through the appeals court process, if there's an appeal through the court process, it goes directly to the Supreme Court. So that's important because there are relatively narrow windows at the federal level for seeking and receiving federal approval. And we want to be able to represent to the administration that we have our land use approvals finalized when we go for those applications for funding. I think the only other thing to note here is that we have had conversations with LCDC and the governor's land use staff to make sure that they're comfortable with the language and the concept, and they represented to us that they are. We've also talked extensively with the local governments that this corridor covers, and they're supportive of this language as well. I'll have Andy talk about this, but one of the things the legislation does is requires us to establish a local government committee that is responsible for developing the proposal for the land use final order, which these criteria then are used to evaluate. So they have extensive involvement, public outreach, many, many meetings over many years to help design the route of the project, which is then carried forward in this land use approval process. So with that,
Andy Shaw with Metro. Just had a couple points to add. I think Bernie covered most of it. This is a really important infrastructure project for our region. The Southwest Corridor represents about 10% of the greater Portland area population, 250,000 jobs in that area. It's one of the fastest growing parts of our region, growing congestion in that area, and addressing both highway and through, we hope, a state transportation package, but also transit functions in our area is very, very important. Back in 2009, this part of our region was identified as the next important area to really focus on transit. We've already been working with a steering committee of local elected officials and community members all along the route, representatives of the educational institutions and businesses and others along that corridor, and they've identified this project with light rail as the solution, as the best way to go forward. We, of course, would convene local elected officials as well for the
land use final order process. When we conduct this, it's a very thorough, very detailed process. Our last LUFO was 188 pages. We didn't print it out, so we wouldn't kill trees to represent that to you. I think that's all I have to add to it. We Metro Council urges you to move this legislation forward. It's a critical piece of getting this significant piece of transportation infrastructure correct.
Thank you. And before I ask if there are questions, committee, I asked for this bill to come to our committee so that I could shepherd it through the process a little bit. And the reason I did that is because in my private law practice, I processed at least two of the local land use applications for the Orange Line station areas. And so I have direct experience of how the land use final order affects local land use planning. And once the final order is done, the local jurisdiction still has to issue land use approvals on individual stations. And the public gets a chance to comment on the orientation of the station, the design, compatibility, and those sorts of things. And those can all be taken into account when you reach your final land use decision on that individual station. But the catch is you can impose conditions at that point to make the project better, but you can't deny it. And that's important because we've got once they start building the light rail line and the stations, they have to keep going because the federal funds flow. And it's very important to keep those federal funds flowing and not have to be held up over time by individual land use appeals, because if you don't meet those your targets and your deadlines for getting the funding used, you have to get back in line for the money. So light rail happens to bring in millions and millions of dollars to our state, and we don't want to run the risk of not capturing that money when we have the opportunity to get it. So with that, I'll open it up for questions. Representative Holby.
Thanks. I'm not real versed in this, but I'm just kind of curious about the criteria that's established for the total corridor. Is that criteria more stringent or less stringent than the individual jurisdictions that would have normally had their land use jurisdiction over this? Or is it a compilation of all of them?
Sure, Chair Helm, Representative Holby. I would say that it's less voluminous. It's probably the best way to put it. The criteria are designed. Obviously, LCDC designs the criteria. Ultimately, they adopt the criteria, and then Metro Council is required to use those criteria in determining whether the alignment is appropriate. And the criteria typically are, they have to do with things like, okay, is it consistent with the regional land use and transportation adopted plans and strategies? Is it consistent with the safe operation of transportation facilities? Does it support local land use objectives? So they tend to be things like that, as opposed to, in each jurisdiction, you tend to have a much more detailed set of criteria because they deal with so many other things besides light rail. So I think that's the major difference, is just in terms of volume rather than in terms of strictness, if you will.
Any further questions, Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question, I don't know if it goes to you or other folks in the room, but how would this bill interact with the larger transportation question that's going on as we talk about a transportation package? How might this fit in and complement, work with, or not, I guess, as we talk about our greater transportation needs throughout the entire metro area and the valley and so forth? So does anybody have an answer to that?
I'd be happy to take a crack at that, Chair Helm, Representative Johnson. Part of the strategy that the region has discussed with the co-chairs of that committee, and particularly with Senator Boquist in the congestion subgroup, has been that the region would be willing to entertain paying half the cost of the major bottleneck projects that both the state and the region have identified as critical areas. So Rose Corridor 205 and 217. And what the region has said is that we would like to package those improvements together with the light rail project. So it relates in that this piece of legislation is necessary to advance the light rail project, and the region has agreed to come forward and support a 50% match of those ODOT facility costs if it's combined with the rail project. So that's essentially how they relate.
Thank you.
I would just add that, if I could, Chair Helm, Representative Johnson, the way that the state package is coming together would have both this state and local match on the highway side, and then we're looking at putting together the resources for the Southwest Corridor, and we would draw down significant funding from the federal level. So it leverages further investment that we on our own can't accommodate, but you know, has in the range of $1 billion from the federal government that we'd be seeking.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I read through this bill twice over the weekend. I found it to be extraordinarily interesting. This one phrase in point of fact, which reads, "The Legislative Assembly deems the procedures and requirements provided in this bill under the unique circumstances of the Southwest Corridor to be the equivalent in spirit and substance to the land use procedures otherwise applicable." I really like that phrase. I'm going to be supporting this bill, but it seems to me odd that we would push our land use stuff aside so that we could draw in all the federal money you're now talking about to the benefit of the Portland area, when I don't see similar alacrity when it comes to my area.
Exacto.
So I'm just asking, would we all be better off if we left our land use processes in place? The part of the state most interested in them struggle with them, as we have to. That's my question to the two of you.
Chair Helm, Representative Benz, I'll answer a part of your question, which I think is, what is different about this than all of the other issues that come before LCDC in terms of land use approvals? And I think the fundamental difference here is that because of the federal funding, we have a very specific window of opportunity. And without getting too deep in the weeds, in order to apply for federal funding for a project like the light rail project, we, the local region, have to invest literally tens of millions of dollars. The federal government won't entertain our application until it has reached a level of maturity. It has a certain amount of planning that's been done, a certain amount of engineering and cost-benefit analysis and so forth. So we have risked 20, 30, 40 million dollars of capital to prepare an application to the federal government. Once we've done that, the federal rules are that you have 2 years to finalize the agreement with the federal government for what's called a full funding grant agreement. Or you're kicked out of the process and you go back to ground zero, and that investment of tens of millions of dollars is essentially wiped out. And so this unique circumstance is that we can't risk that kind of capital investment unless we have a very clear pathway to having a final decision on the land use appeals process. So that, I think, is the fundamental distinction between this and many of the other land use issues that might come before folks.
Well, what?
Thank you, Chair, for your indulgence, but I would just be stating the obvious, so yeah. I'll waive my opportunity.
Your comment is noted. Representative Power.
Representative Benz, I was going to offer to brief you on the experiences in Clackamas County around the Orange Line, and I appreciate your comments on this. In our experience in running the Orange Line through, at the 11th hour, we had some folks elected at the county level who would have stopped or tried to stop this process very late. Those folks were then not reelected 4 years later, but had we not had this sort of framework in place, it would have caused, I think, a lot of angst, difficulty, lost costs to the state at the last minute.
Yes, Representative Bannon.
Thank you, Representative Power, for that. Those remarks. I will simply say that if you have a large project and big piles of money to the benefit of a major population area in the state, the enthusiasm for setting these rules aside is palpable. If you're a small rural area and you have equal amounts of money involved on a relative scale, you don't get this kind of help. That's my point. And so, indeed, there are bazillions of opportunities where we need to get this kind of haystacks of regulatory barriers out of the road. I'm just asking that this group remember this discussion, because there's other bills coming.
I appreciate both your comments, and I'd like to move forward now. Our paperwork isn't quite ready on this one, so I'll be closing the public hearing on House Bill 3202 and carrying over the work session on House Bill 3202 until tomorrow's agenda. I've got two. Actually, I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2725 and invite Representative Kenny Geyer forward. And go ahead, Beth, and remind us what this is.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2725, you have a dash one amendment. It has a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. You originally heard this measure on 2-1. The dash one amendment replaces the measure and appropriates $1 million from the general fund to the Residential Solid Fuel Heating Air Quality Improvement Fund to support community efforts to improve economic development and public health by reducing air quality emissions from solid fuel burning devices that burn wood. It declares an emergency effective on passage. There's a no revenue impact and a fiscal impact issued on the measure.
Welcome, Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You said that you had just a brief comment on this.
Very brief.
Bill, and then we can move it ahead.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Members of the committee, I'm Melissa Kenny Geyer, House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. And I had a bill, this original bill, House Bill 2725, dealing with the wood smoke program. Representative Johnson also had a bill, 2748. Representative Mitch Greenlick also had a bill, and we converged them all into Representative Johnson's bill, in part because he had been a member of the task force and had been working on this issue. Representative Johnson came at it more from an economic development perspective, concerned with non-attainment areas that couldn't do any more economic development until they had reached attainment. And Representative Greenlick and I, being on the Health Committee, came at it from more of a public health perspective about concern about wood smoke in among the population. So that was a great meeting of the minds, and I know that committee, that you all passed that bill. I know there were a couple of dissenting votes on this committee because of concern that it may not have enough flexibility, and there have been conversations actually prior to that and after that about building in some flexibility. We really want to focus on the wood smoke replacement program. We want to stick with the bill that Representative Johnson put forward, which is why we did stick with that. But the Senate side is looking at adding a waiver process for very small communities like Oak Ridge that might be able to reduce the wood smoke in their air through other kinds of means. So this committee, I bring that up because this bill that I'm proposing here is to fund that program. We wanted to use different vehicles because we did not want Representative Johnson's policy bill to languish in Ways and Means. So his went through and is the policy, and we're going to set up the fund whether we get money for it or not. That fund is now set up, hopefully, once it gets past the Senate. This was, okay, once you have a fund, let's fund it. So I wanted to make sure that you were up to date on the conversations, because I'm hoping for a unanimous vote out of this committee to request $1 million from Ways and Means to support the program that Representative Johnson is setting up in his bill. So if there are any questions, just wanted to clarify that point. Thank you for that opportunity.
Thank you, Representative. And if you could stay put, I think we're going to move to your other bill here in just a minute. Any questions for Representative Kenny Geyer? Representative Johnson.
Not really a question, Mr. Chair, but just a comment. I think I referenced this bill and Representative Kenny Geyer's efforts last week when we had our other policy bill in front of the committee. So I supported the policy bill, and I'll support moving this down to Ways and Means as well.
Any other comments? Good.
With that, I'll entertain a motion on this bill.
Chair Helm, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated April 3rd, 2017.
Representative Power moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated April 3, 2017. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The amendment passes.
Chair Helm, I move House Bill 2725 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Power moves House Bill 2725 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk... Representative Holby.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Chair. I will be a courtesy yes on this bill, awaiting the flexibility in this program.
Thank you for that. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Reschke?
Aye.
Representative Brocksmith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Power?
Aye.
Chair Helm?
Aye. The motion passes, and the bill will be sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you. And at this time, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3105. So, folks, we've got this bill up, and I also have a public hearing scheduled for House Bill 3343. I intend to get both of them done today, so don't panic. You'll all be heard, and committee members, to the extent you're able to stay past 4:45, I'd appreciate it. We can get both of these bills done before that time. And I'll invite you to introduce this bill, and if you want to invite any other folks up to join you, you may at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, it's Alyssa Kennegeyer, House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland, and Representative McLean is actually the chief sponsor of this bill and was sitting next to me and then was called away to testify on a different bill. So she was going to be the lead on this. I'll just say very briefly that some of you know that I've worked on trying to reduce toxics. I have a public health background, and making sure that we reduce our exposure to toxins is very important for the human population, but as well, fish and our environment, because we know that toxics leach into the waterways. So I became very interested in this bill and visited the hazardous waste facility at Metro, sent my staff, who's sitting in the room here, to one of the stakeholder groups that was trying to put together this Household Hazardous Waste Product Stewardship Program, and I'm very honored to support Representative McLean. She worked as a Metro counselor for many, many years and knew and loved the hazardous waste program very well. I know that the program costs about $4.5 million to taxpayers. About $150,000 is collected in fees by people who actually do the right thing and bring the hazardous waste back rather than put them into garbage and other places where they can do damage not only to the environment but also to the waste handlers, people who are collecting it. Not realize that there's hazardous materials. So it's a great program. I do feel that industry should be a part of the cost of their product all the way from production through the waste disposal of it. So making sure that they share in some of those external costs is important, and that is basically what this program is trying to do. It started with a much bigger list of products, and it's really been narrowed down through really good conversations that we've had. So I will leave it at that, and I hope that Representative McLean comes very soon, but turn it over to
Scott,
to my colleague. Yeah.
Very good. Thank you. And if you have other things to attend to, you'd be quite welcome to do that work. And I think I can invite up Dave McCall and David.
Thank you.
David Sketz?
Skakel. Skakel.
Skakel. Go right ahead, Scott.
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, Vice Chair Power. My name is Scott Clegg. I work at Metro, and also...
Hey, Scott, let's hold up just a minute. We got Representative McLean back.
Oh, wonderful.
Let's get her comment really as an introduction.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Welcome back.
Yes, it's
one of those exciting times right before the deadline, right?
Yes.
Okay. Hello. I would really appreciate just taking a breath. Okay. Chair Helm and members of the committee, thank you so much for letting us be here today. And for the record, my name is Susan McLean, and I represent House District 29, which spans West Washington County. We're here to talk to you today, and I realize that my representative friend, Alyssa, has probably already spoken. And so I'll just start out by saying that the household hazardous waste programs take unwanted waste out of the home, reducing the risk of poisoning and fires out of traditional recycling bins, protects waste and landfill workers. And these programs also protect environment by diverting hazardous material from improper disposal down interior drains and toilets and down street drains or yards or ditches where the material can make its way into treatment plants or streams or rivers. I believe, along with many health experts, and I'm sure that Alyssa spoke to this, that household hazardous waste that is collected is a very important prevention program. By collecting this material upstream, we avoid safety risks downstream, and stewardship programs make a difference. E-waste and paint programs here in Oregon have been very, very successful, and they've helped us in all of the ways that we need to protect the environment and protect our families and make a safer place when we're using these kinds of HHWs. I am really pleased that you're going to get a chance to hear the details of this bill, and I want you to note that there are some amendments. The one amendment that you'll hear and see today is based on the Senate hearing on Senate Bill 199. We made these changes in response to the industry that said that needed a very important phase-in period and more time, and we listened. This Dash 1 amendments will not start until April of 2019, and we will have plenty of time for a thoughtful phase-in with plenty of input from the industry. The stewardship program matches our values as Oregonians. I see this as a consumer protection issue. I see it as a safety issue, an environmental issue, a public health issue, and as I'm sure the other representative already indicated, a fairness issue as well. Manufacturers, all users, and all of the system should be an equitable system, and we all should help pay. The approach allows for a very innovative phase-in with much tooling by the industry, and I am really here to just answer any questions you might have after our presentation.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Let's get the Daves back, David and Dave. Come on up. And if I can, we can pull up an additional chair and maybe
okay, let's see if we
here. Right ahead. And I certainly don't want to shortchange the time that we have for you, but as concise as possible would help us.
Yes, Chair.
Thanks. Go ahead, Scott.
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, Vice Chair Power, members of the committee. My name is Scott Clagg. I'm a senior planner at Metro, and my colleague Jim Quinn is my partner on this project, and he's in the row if you have any technical questions on that. He manages our household hazardous waste program. Jim and I presented the concepts behind this legislation at an informational hearing before this committee during the 2015 session. At that hearing, we were charged with working with stakeholders on the bill, and we had meetings to that effect, and the bill as amended reflects some of those conversations. I will keep my remarks brief. We have placed a much more detailed presentation on the committee's website, so you're welcome to take a look at that if you want some more technical information about how the program will work. As Representative McLean talked about and Representative Kenny Geyer, what this program deals with are the leftover from products that you have in your home that need to be more safely managed. In particular, particular, the bill addresses things like lawn and garden products, such as pesticides and herbicides, flammables, such as solvents, corrosives, like heavy-duty drain cleaners, that if properly managed, they can have risks, you know, at your home with your children and poisoning and fires and other things that the representative also described. Oregon communities have supported, over the years, household hazardous waste programs across the state. However, local governments in the state and the DEQ have borne all the responsibility for the costs of those programs. Our objective with this legislation is to have industry share in that responsibility and establish an efficient and effective statewide program. The legislation will achieve this objective by utilizing a product stewardship approach, where the manufacturers selling these products into the state must ensure the safe, convenient, and environmentally sound collection and disposal of their products. Specifically, the legislation is going to cover those products that require a special event or facility to manage their return. Products that might be safely returned to retail, something like batteries or maybe compact fluorescent lights, are not covered by this program. Discussions with stakeholders have also helped us refine the scope of the covered products and are reflected in those amendments. Excluded products include e-waste and paint, since they're already covered by stewardship legislation, as well as commercial pesticides and cosmetic and beauty products. During our discussions with stakeholders, we heard a number of concerns about ensuring the program was workable. That is to say, we heard there were concerns regarding the number of manufacturers affected, how DEQ could be ensured that they could effectively implement and oversee the program, and about how to coordinate with existing household hazardous waste programs that are out there around the state. We've taken efforts to address these concerns, especially by having a longer startup time. The program won't get underway until 2019, and three-year phase-in for scopes of the products that will be covered. We think this will provide the necessary time for industry and the DEQ and also local governments to get aligned with these programs and get them underway. We're also trying in our own facilities to do some work to help speed the sorting and the processing of these materials using some data analysis, some scanning equipment. So that's really what I'd like to say today, and I'll leave it to my other colleagues in the H-Waste business to talk. Thank you.
Go right ahead when you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Helm and committee. My name is David Skakel, and I manage a 3-county, 6-city hazardous waste program in rural Oregon, so providing somewhat of a rural perspective. And our program participated in what I think Oregon's good at, a stakeholder process back in 2010, which culminated with assistance from Metro, which culminated in a report called Recommendations for Product Stewardship in Oregon. So in that context, having vetted out essentially the issue of product stewardship, a finding of that broad stakeholder one-year process was that, in fact, we should involve manufacturers more so in the end-of-life management of unwanted hazardous waste. And our program, like I said, we coalesced 3 counties and 6 cities to try to afford hazardous waste collection. But I can tell you that one part of the problem is that 9 counties, 1/4 of counties in Oregon have no hazardous waste facilities, program, or regular hazardous waste collection events. And extrapolating from our own collection, I'd say that's over 1,300,000 pounds of hazardous waste a year. I don't know where it goes, but I think that's an issue for what we love most of all here, the natural resources here in Oregon. That's Wheeler, Harney, Lake, Douglas, Jefferson, Klamath, Malheur, and Umatilla counties. And finally, just to make a point, my phone call on the way out the door here today was from a lady who asked, what can she do with her DDT, which was outlawed in 1972. She found in her father's garage on the banks of the Deschutes River in Maupin, Oregon. And that exemplifies the type of materials that are they are really dangerous and hazardous, and we want to collectively cost share with manufacturers to provide regular solutions. Thank you very much.
Very good.
So Chair Helm, I'm a member of the committee, members of the committee. My name is David McCall, and I'm the Solid Waste Program Manager from Tillamook County. I appreciate the opportunity to share with you very shortly part of our experience with EPR programs and hazardous waste through our program. Tillamook County has been collecting hazardous waste for well over a decade, but we were the first county on the Oregon coast to actually build and operate a permanent collection facility for hazardous waste. That opened back in 2011. What we've seen over the last 5 years, as compared to previously, when it was once a year collection events, where we would have 300, 400 cars backed up trying to get rid of their things once a year, what we've seen is now that we have a permanent facility, our quantities have increased 2.5 times over what they were beforehand. Very interestingly, though, during that same period of time, our costs have gone down by 1%. Now, part of the reason that those costs have not gone up along with the quantities of hazardous waste is because of the efficiencies involved with a permanent facility. But part of the, a very significant part of the reason is because the paint stewardship program came into being and in effect in Oregon, and that has taken an incredible financial burden off of our shoulders. It's reduced that, it hasn't completely taken it off, it has reduced the burden that we share and that our ratepayers have had to pay for. And the benefit we see with the program envisioned through this bill is that it will enable us to further reduce those costs that our ratepayers are paying and free up that money so that we don't have to raise our rates that our ratepayers are paying, but we'll have additional funds available to apply to valuable programs in our program. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Holby.
You mentioned the ratepayers. Which ratepayers are paying this? Do you have a special taxing district for hazardous waste, or is it some other county just generally?
The way Chair Helm and Representative Hovey, the way it works in our county is the solid waste program is administered through a separate solid waste service district, and the funding for that service district comes from the tipping fee. So whether the garbage man picks up your garbage at your door or whether you bring it to the transfer station as a self hauler, you are paying for the disposal of that waste, and we charge you more than it actually costs us to dispose of the waste. That margin on our garbage is what we use to pay for the hazardous waste program.
All right, thanks.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my question is more for our Metro colleagues here, but you currently have a program in place that addresses the solid, the stuff we're talking about, right? Why is that not working? And it just seems to me, I want to get back to kind of Representative Benz's comments earlier, that I think that was another example of a topic where it's the metro area that's driving a program that we want to impose statewide. And I'm not hearing that desire from more rural areas to implement this. It seems to be driven by metro. So it's been working fine for you up to this point, but why do we feel like we need to take this program statewide or have the state come in now and pick up a program that you've been successfully administering on your own?
Okay. If I may, Rep. Johnson, are in a similar situation. Our programs, I didn't want to mention to complicate the scene, but our programs are generally tied to funding from solid waste fees, which are rather tumultuous because of our mission to help reduce the very solid waste tonnage that we derive our funding from, and also contamination issues, and currently, as with the City of Hood River, starting this month, attempts to divert organics, food, and yard waste from landfills as well, which is something that is a good thing, but it's not so much for funding. And the programs are in place, we're funded, but also there's a continuing proliferation of new chemicals every day, and in addition to the legacy pesticides that I mentioned, like DDT. So they just keep coming. It's not like there was a big stockpile that worked itself down, and just a continual transition. The mercury light bulbs above our heads are probably 15% of our disposal budget every year, and they just keep coming.
Follow-up.
So how would we propose for Oregon to implement this as a standalone state? How can this be implemented effectively as we talk about doing something that other states are not, from the manufacturers and from the supplier standpoint?
Well, if it implements the way the electronics e-cycles program and PinkCare have so far in Oregon and in other states and countries, our hope would be that on the ground we continue to our operations as we have, and effectively it's more of a cost share with the manufacturers. So by example, when I go out to Maupin this Saturday, we don't have a half a dozen different product stewardship programs showing up at different trucks and events. It's all one event, one truck, and there are a variety of industries in the background assisting our ratepayers, and occasionally DEQ providing state assistance as well. So it's not asking for an entire bricks and mortar new program, but more background assistance, cost share by manufacturers.
Further questions? Representative Holby.
Just one more. Just really curious. I noticed that batteries are not a covered product, and it seems like that would be an easy one to have a stewardship program. Why is battery such a sticking point?
Chair Helm, Representative Holby. Batteries, there's been several national initiatives about that. As I understand, actually the primary, you know, your non-rechargeable batteries and the rechargeable battery folks are working together to try and have legislation. I think they ran some recently in Texas. And that's a program that we think is going to be stewarded perhaps at a national level. We've been hoping for a number of years. We do take those batteries already at programs. There are take-back programs for those now. But it's something that is this bill is focused on, you know, the more hazardous materials. Those batteries you can take back, you know, to a bunch of retail stores also. So that's why we thought being there is an existing program and being that we're more focused on certain other products.
Thank you very much for being here. We appreciate your testimony in this bill. I invite up at this time Jay Douglas, Katie Fast, and Mike Freese. Let's go right ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Helm, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Jay Douglas. I'm the Environmental Health Director for Multnomah County. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today on behalf in support of House Bill 3105. At Multnomah County, we have a specific interest in reducing all the ways that people can be exposed to toxics. And we know that the home can be a significant and sometimes surprising source of exposure to these various products. Nationally, we know that there are 33 states that have product stewardship efforts in place that address a number of exposures. And here in Oregon, you've just heard that we have several, including in Multnomah County. They prevent these materials from being entering into the waste stream, and also prevent exposures to human health. You know, we know that people maintain old pesticides in their homes, old paint, where those exposures can easily happen. We do actively support the change in fees, a charging of fees to producers commensurate with the amount of hazardous waste contained in the products covered. The fee not only shifts the responsibility back to a shared responsibility, but it also can motivate long-term reductions in the amount of hazardous waste that are contained in the products. We do believe that this should be a shared responsibility and support the move toward increased transparency and ultimately encouraging the substitution of less toxic materials and products. Thank you for the time, your time and attention. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Hi. Good afternoon. For the record, Katie Fast with Oregonians for Food and Shelter. We have written testimony submitted under the name of Scott Dahlman that I'll refer to, and I'll be quick. OFS represents farmers, foresters, and other pesticide users, along with the manufacturers and distributors. We participated in the Metro work group, had concerns through the process, and have submitted during those work groups a letter with our concerns that had several other groups signed on to that's part of our written testimony. Our concerns with 3105 is that it creates an overly complicated program. The program's extremely broad, very different than the paint and e-waste programs that have been referred to because of the large number of products that also isn't well-defined in the legislation about what's included in this product stewardship program. It is also not transparent like the paint program where right now if you go buy a can of paint, it has on the receipt what the cost of the program is to the consumer. This is going to be passed on to the consumer, but we're really not aware right now on what the costs and the rates are going to be in the creation of the associations and the product stewardship program. We additionally have concerns that pesticides don't fit well in the program for a few different reasons. One, we have over 12,000 products registered in the state of Oregon, and that's only one of the categories that's included in the stewardship program. The Dash Ones attempt to exempt out agricultural pesticides, but there isn't a clear category description between what's an agricultural pesticide, what's a homeowner pesticide, what's being used in a landscape, what's being used in an enclosed siting area also. Our containers are already recyclable. There are several programs to recycle those through currently in the system. And it's very unclear if we're going to see more household hazardous waste collected through this proposal or if we are just underwriting the cost of existing programs through other payers' means. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Fries with Associated Oregon Industries. I'm here on behalf of AOI and OBA. We represent about 1,600 member businesses in Oregon who employ approximately 250,000 Oregonians. We represent businesses of all types, including manufacturers and probably more importantly in this context, retailers from across the state who will be impacted by many of the provisions that are outlined in House Bill 3105, which we oppose. So like Oregonians for Food and Shelter, AOI was at the table during the interim to discuss with Metro their plans in moving forward with the product stewardship program. We outlined many of our concerns that ultimately have not been addressed in this particular bill. I would say one of the most significant concerns that is yet to be addressed is Metro has decided to cite to federal regulations and quite broad description of what could be provided as covered products under the program. And I have had a number of manufacturers from across the country contact me about what is or what is not included, what level of those chemicals would be required to be put in place, and can you substitute chemicals, and what would that mean for a number of the products that consumers have here. And it was really hard, I think, both in my questioning Metro as to what are the, if we go into a store, what are the products that you see as needing to participate in this program? And we never really did get a good understanding, at least from Metro's perspective, of what that means. Moreover, the balancing test that is required as far as what goes into a consumer's hands and then what must go back into the product stewardship program doesn't make a lot of sense. This whole balance of, well, we're going to base a target on what you sell and then what comes back in based on the previous year may not actually mean much depending upon what products are no longer available, what products have different chemical components. Many of our members that do produce these consumer products try to produce better products every year, understanding that they too would like to make more environmentally friendly products. So, and then I would say third, there's not a lot of clear direction for DEQ here, and I'm struggling to figure out what this is going to cost for DEQ to review a program of this size and scope without significant fees that would be associated that would then be passed on to consumers. So for those reasons and some others that I think that you'll find in the Scott Dahlman's submitted testimony, we urge you to vote no on this particular bill. Thanks.
Questions for this panel? Representative Brock Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as a former commissioner, I was the liaison to the Household Hazardous Waste Program for actually, we have a dual county, Coos and Curry counties. The program has worked very well for us down there in Southwest Oregon. We had a collection site at the Beaver Hill site is there, but we would also rotate collection sites around the county to make it easier and more efficient for the folks to bring in their waste. So I just wanted to add that for the record, historic hands-on knowledge of the information.
Okay, thank you. Representative Holby.
Thanks. Katie, I'm kind of curious. Is there a program for commercial agricultural pesticides? What happens to those products when the commercial industries have excess or unused, or what do they do with their waste?
So, Chair Helm, Representative Holvey, there is a state-designated take-back center in Brooks that has collection sites that they'll rotate through the state. Additionally, DEQ currently does take-backs for all products at different times throughout the year. And that's not just limited to agricultural containers.
Follow up? And how do they pay for that?
Chair Helm, Representative Holvey, for the DEQ program, that's part of their budget, part of the pesticide stewardship program, and in that designation. For the agricultural containers, there is a national council that grants different entities in each state to have this voluntary program available.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, I wanted to get back to your comments about DEQ and I guess what it's going to take to administer the program. In Section 9, it says DEQ shall charge an annual fee to be paid by a stewardship organization that is sufficient to cover the cost of administering, implementing, and enforcing the provisions. And then it goes on down into Section 13. Section 13, the administrative fee required to be paid under Section 9 of this Act shall be set at $85,000 unless the department determines that a higher fee is necessary to cover the costs and so forth. So what does all that mean to you, and who are these environmental organizations or these stewardship organizations that are in question here? Does that make, that's part of what you were alluding to, I think, just the lack of clarity on the funding and what it's going to require to administer?
Chair Helm, Representative Johnson, that is a part of the discussion. One is, I think we have to understand how many stewardship programs will exist to even understand if $85,000 is reasonable. What we can't seem to get a grasp of is how many stewardship organizations does Metro and DEQ believe will spring up as a result of the passage of this bill, and therefore how many different entities will DEQ have to provide oversight over, and then again, how much will that cost? So while we understand what the floor is going to be at $85,000, we actually don't know what the entire program cost is going to be. And so it's really hard to understand the entire program from DEQ's perspective, or I would think it would be hard to understand if you don't know how many different programs will be created.
Paul. Mr. Chair, I would just like to get on the record. I think it would be really important or helpful to get that information from DEQ at some point, as what their plans are and how this would all be administered.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3105, and I'm going to carry over the work session on House Bill 3105 to tomorrow's agenda. And at this time, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3343 and invite Trish Weber. And Trish, did you have anybody helping you make this presentation? With and Rhett Lawrence? And I'd like to invite Mark Gamba up at this time as well. Thank you for persevering through our other measures. And welcome.
Busy day.
Yeah. Go right ahead when you're ready.
Mark, do you want to start? Or? I know you need to get out of here.
Sure. Good afternoon, Chair Helm, members of the committee. My name is Mark Gamba. I'm the mayor of Milwaukee. You may be aware that the Willamette Valley experienced an unusual wind event this last Friday. Annette Mattson of PGE is quoted as saying this is the biggest storm we've experienced since 2006. At the peak, about 168,000 customers were out. As of this writing, PGE has almost 95,000 customers out, about 30,000 in Clackamas County. No estimates are yet available, but one would have to assume that the cost of the windstorm is well into the millions of dollars of damage. A few months ago, the Willamette Valley experienced some other unusual weather. Here's a quote from the Oregonian from February 13th. Portland is requesting more than $3.2 million in federal disaster aid to cover the cost of responding to the record-setting snow and ice storms that ravaged the city's roads, water pipes, and power lines in January, and that was only the cost to the city itself. Many of the businesses in Portland and the Portland region suffered all kinds of costs that when neither their employees nor their customers could reach their businesses for whole weeks. And a year ago this last December, we suffered an unprecedented rain event which cost the city of Milwaukee alone around $2 million in damaged park and washed out bridge footing. What all these have in common is that extreme weather events are becoming more common, which is exactly what scientists 30 years ago predicted when they first warned us about climate change. Those extreme weather events cost our society, our cities, and our businesses a great deal of money, and we are just beginning to feel the effects of climate change. Eventually, the weather will become so erratic that farmers will have great difficulty growing food, the food that our nation needs. Imagine the costs associated with millions of starving people. As it stands now, none of our state agencies are allowed to consider climate change when considering a permit. This is a glaring flaw in our system. As we all consider the economic benefits of a project, we also need to be able to consider all of the economic costs, both in the near term and in the future, when weighing whether a given project is of benefit or of detriment to the state. The Milwaukee City Council unanimously passed a resolution in strong support of this bill, which we submitted in writing earlier, so I won't waste your time by reading it to you. But I think this is a critical piece of legislature that, as a member of this SELA, which is the Safe Energy Leadership Alliance, 165 members spread over several states and British Columbia, when we were attempting to address some carbon infrastructure over the last few years, the state of Washington had more tools to be able to look at that infrastructure than Oregon has. And this is a bill that would rectify that. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, again, Rhett Lawrence, I'm the conservation director for the Oregon Chapter of the Sierra Club. I'll be brief. I have submitted written testimony in the OLIS. But as an organization with a long history of working to move beyond fossil fuels in Oregon, the Sierra Club strongly supports House Bill 3343. We've been raising the need for a more coordinated and comprehensive view of large fossil fuel projects for a number of years now, and we believe the climate test proposed by House Bill 3343 is an excellent and necessary tool for Oregon to implement as we begin to deal with the climate changes already upon us. And in essence, as I think you know, and as will be discussed in more detail by my colleague Trish here, this bill would essentially create a state level and more particularized version of the National Environmental Policy Act. We don't have in Oregon a state Environmental Policy Act, a SEPA, unlike our neighbors to the north and south, which allows agencies considering large projects to coordinate across agencies to work at a more comprehensive level to consider the various effects those projects might have. And this bill would give us that overarching mechanism. Would also require that climate impacts factor into those permitting decisions, which is not currently required. So we think that is a very important addition to this legislation. And as Trish will explain in more detail momentarily, there's an economic assessment that must be done under the climate test, and so we believe that is also an important aspect to the bill. Oregon Chapter of the Sierra Club believes that this is really a necessary piece of legislation to allow us to begin looking at these large fossil fuel projects at a comprehensive level, making sure that that the climate impacts are being taken into account, and as a piece of legislation that could really move our state forward and make us a leader. So we strongly support the bill, urges the committee to do the same, and happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Helm and members of the committee. My name is Patricia Weber, and I live in Corvallis. Thank you for the opportunity to present testimony in support of HB 3343 with the Dash 1 Amendment, the climate test bill. So I would like to begin my testimony by borrowing something that a friend of mine says. Attribution goes to Eric DePlace of Sightline Institute. So that is that there are essentially two ways to bring about the zombie apocalypse. And the first is to continue using fossil fuels exactly the way we do now without changing. The second is to stop using all fossil fuels tomorrow. Not being a fan of the zombie apocalypse, our challenge over the next several decades is to figure out a way to ramp down our fossil fuels at a pace that limits global warming to less than catastrophic levels, while at the same time not crashing the global economy. In December of 2015, 195 countries convened in Paris and signed what has become known as the Paris Climate Accord, in which the signatories pledged to limit climate change to well below 2 degrees C by the year 2100. This pledge means that jurisdictions all over the world will take the steps needed to decarbonize the global economy, which will drastically alter the demand and thus the price of fossil fuels. Case in point, Senate Bill 557. Which, right here in Oregon, we're considering taking this action. Here in Oregon, we need to base our fossil fuel infrastructure policy on what we expect the global energy economy will be based on the Paris Accord, not what the fossil fuel industry would like business as usual to continue as. Oregon as a state has relatively low GHG emissions, especially compared to larger economies like our neighbor to the south. However, our geographic location between the large fossil fuel reserves in the interior of the continent and potential markets in Asia means that our deep water ports are highly desirable for the shipment of fossil fuels across the world. The evidence of this is manifested in the numerous large-scale fossil fuel infrastructure projects, such as pipelines and export terminals, that have been proposed over the past several years. We're a vital link in a global supply network, and as such should make our fossil fuel infrastructure policy decisions in the context of global energy markets. The climate test is a powerful, inexpensive, and efficient tool for evaluating whether a large-scale fossil fuel infrastructure project would be a good fit for Oregon. The key element of the climate test is the requirement for an economic viability analysis under a well below 2 degrees C scenario. This will determine whether the risks to our air, water, wildlife, and climate posed by fossil fuel mega projects are justified by the promises of jobs that accompany them. If we have reason to believe that the price of fossil fuels will drop to the point where a given infrastructure project will not be profitable and will instead go out of business in relatively short order, we should not be investing our valuable deep water ports in it. The climate test will provide us the information we need to make that determination. Oregon should say no to stranded assets and yes to sustainable economy. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from committee members? Thank you very much for bringing us this bill. Appreciate you being here.
Thanks.
Let's see. Tracy Farwell and Ed Averill and Lucinda. I'll let you say that when you get up here. Maybe I'll see you later. I'm lucky. Okay. Hello. In the interest of getting us out of here in a decent time, I am going to put folks on the timer now that the initial presentation's made, but I'm going to give you 3 minutes, so go right ahead, first person that's ready.
Chair Helm, remaining members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tracy Farwell, representing a small Oregon climate research effort. We regard the merit of HB 3343 climate testing is not so much that it buys down risk in the next decades, but rather it forecloses taking on more risk. The risks at hand are described in monetary terms. As we described in our testimony on file with OLIS for this hearing, and thank you for the opportunity to be heard today, the impact of climate change, according to the Brookings Institution citation, is a 20% hit on global GDP by the year 2100. On top of that, the Guardian News Service reports that if left unchecked, continued climate change causes global financial assets to be overvalued by $2.5 trillion based on current numbers. The damage to the U.S. economy, according to the NRDC study, will grow to $1.9 trillion annually by 2100. A study reported by the West Coast Economic Research Group based in California predicts at least a $2 billion loss against Oregon's GDP. We don't know of any authoritative Oregon research to confirm this. We know members of the House and Senate Environment Committees have asked those giving testimony to please explain what benefits any cuts in Oregon CO2 will have in reducing CO2 on a U.S. scale or globally. And on two occasions, those giving testimony were unable to answer the question. And we do that in the paper that we filed for testimony today. The numbers tell us that when we try to understand what control we have over Oregon's climate future, there's virtually no leverage in our favor. Oregon's total contribution to global CO2 emissions is 0.1%. This is a ratio of 1 to 1,000. Climate impacts seem to be leveraged against us 1,000 to 1. Oregon's vulnerability to climate damage, while others reap carbon profits, could be a bitter pill. Our antidote with this bill is to manage our own carbon inventory, and in doing so, demonstrate a rare instance of both mercy and hope. Thank you for taking testimony.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ed Averill from Beaverton, and I'd like to say that the purpose of a climate test is to protect the climate. It's not really to find profitable projects. The climate does need protecting, and it needs protecting at a global level. Tracy just pointed out that that Oregon, if it acted alone, would be helpless. But projects can be had that are profitable because they're fossil fuel projects, or they can be profitable because they're green energy projects, or they're projects that have nothing to do with either that can be profitable. And I don't think that this bill should be looking at that kind of issue. So the point of having the test is to avoid damaging the climate. And in the absence of doing that, what we're doing is putting at risk not just lots of loss of GNP, but actually the lack of existence of our seventh generation. It's a pretty important thing to do, and I don't know how to measure or how to bias. There's no money that can solve the problem of how we avoid that. So I think this bill was written with the intent of giving us that protection, and I think that the modifications that have gone into it have added other features of investment that I don't think help its purpose. I think it should concentrate on avoiding the climate risk. That should be the test.
Thank you.
My name's Lucinda Heights Claybaugh. I live in Forest Grove. And Representative Marsh, Hulvey, and Chair Helm, we are facing the lifeboat stage. The Titanic is sinking. And the only thing we can do is to stop what we have currently been doing, and we cannot continue business as usual. And as a scientist, I refer you again to the United Nations 2014 Emissions Gap Report. Over 100 international scientists put their energies and knowledge into the report. The data is confirmable. It is verifiable. The mathematics is sound. And it tells us that we will not make it to 2100 that you're proposing in your amendments. The math tells us that by 2025, we are going to be looking at a true crisis of existence on this planet because of the lack of oxygen, the continued use of our sixth major and now a seventh form of greenhouse gas, to the point that we will have an extinction event similar to what happened to the dinosaurs. The same levels will be there. The actual measurements from United Nations satellite data, actual measurements, tell us this. Now, why the heck isn't the world leadership doing something about this? Well, some of them are. Denmark has come forward, and they've said, we are showing you how we can do this for the whole country to use renewables today for one day. All right, now we'll show you how you can do it for a week. We'll show you how you can use renewables for a month. We will show you how you can use renewables, how you change your habits, because we have to. Because you have grandchildren and great-grandchildren that you want to be born, and you want to have a future. We do this not for our selfish self-interest. We do it for the commons of the planet itself. We do it for our children and a future. We look at science and we say no. So you're going to have to remove that 2100 number. It doesn't fit the science. We're telling you, and I believe that you took these into my testimony on March 1st and said, this is what actually is happening. We're looking at 10 years. In 10 years, we have to make a difference in what we do and how we do it. That means we cannot have business as usual. I'm sorry, but we just can't. We can start now, though, in these next 3 years, because the report, the GAAP report from the United Nations said by 2020, we have to have some serious change, or the uptick is very, very steep. And we can't be fiddling around at the last minute trying to save ourselves as a planet when people didn't set the things into place seriously. And I'm afraid it is a very serious situation. I don't want to be the one to tell you this, but as a scientist and mathematician, I have to, because we do have the capabilities of making this survivable. We will continue to have heat at 84 times because of the methane. Forget about the carbon for a minute. Just the methane is going to keep things going with a ceiling. It's like we've got a bubble around our planet, just like a city urban environment has a bubble of heat. NASA will tell you that through its research going back 20 years.
Lucinda, I need to have you wrap up,
okay.
Please.
All right. Well, I'd once again like to admit that our targets are not good enough. I'm sorry, they don't fit the math. And we have enough proof that we will not be here in 2100. It's not a good target. If we're serious about change, we need to change those numbers, and that includes the numbers you had here on a minimum of 500,000 metric tons. Come on, all of these need to be, in the same way they talked about products and be responsible from your product from beginning to end, take a little responsibility, everybody, for it from beginning to end. What are we doing? It's got to be all of the atmospheric carbon dioxide equivalents, not when they only have a minimum 500,000 metric tons. That's ridiculous. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much for your testimony today.
We would be happy to answer any questions and start from the beginning on some very basic science as to why we need to do what we need to do. And we'd be happy to help people put renewables in place instead.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for your testimony today. We appreciate it.
Is it Sue? Did I get that right?
Sue Craig. I have essential tremor. I don't think you can read that at all.
Well, I got pretty close.
Okay.
And then, Sue, I'm going to get, if Claudia is still here, I don't see her, but Gary Bauer, come on up as well.
No, Claudia isn't here.
Go right ahead, Sue.
Okay, my name is Sue Craig, and I am all in favor of this, and I will tell you why. I am at the bottom of the heap. I am a member of Sierra Club. I'm a member of 350.org. I am a member of about five other organizations that are very much in need of this basic kind of structure from you. We need that leadership, okay? And if we don't get it, I'll tell you what's happening to us because of the necessity to prevent the fossil fuel utilities from coming in and putting infrastructure in our state. What we have to do is go against them. And what that means is we have to go and march, and we have to go and stand in front of them. And a lot of us have to get arrested and all that kind of thing, because we've got to change the laws, because this earth, because of necessity to look after it, needs us. And three of the organizations that I represent here today are religious-based, faith-based, wide kinds of faith, and we really feel this is important. So it is either we get out there in the trenches, which we have been doing, which takes a lot of energy, and all kinds of energy, including fossil fuel energy at this point, unfortunately. And so this would help us a great deal to keep the fossil fuel basic structure out of this state, which we truly need to do. And I thank you all for presenting this in the first place, and please keep up the good work. We need it. Thank you.
Thank you. Gary.
Thank you, Chair Helm, Representative Holvey, Representative Marsh, Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. As one of the few entities that would probably be covered by this test, wanted to say that if you decide to go forward, there are a few things we'd like to work with you on. Depending on, so you'll understand up front, as a regulated utility, we're required under state law to provide safe, adequate, and reliable service, which means we're required to continue to invest in our facilities. And if our customers demand the service, we're required to provide that service. So that means that we do have to make investments in infrastructure. For example, we recently built and expanded our Willamette Valley service feeder, which went down to Corvallis. Corvallis, Philomath had service problems. In addition, Oregon State University built a combined heat and power project that needed additional resources to fuel that project. Depending on whether you go with the original bill or the dash one, kind of helps decide what is considered a large facility. Otherwise, large is kind of in the eyes of the beholder, and that to us needs definitely some clarification. Even at the extent of large, it kind of depends on how you look at it. We are in the process of building out our storage facility at Mist and a new pipeline down to serve Portland General Electric's Wind Chaser plant, which is a gas-fired facility that's designed to automatically go up and down and follow the wind. And our facility will do the same. It'll be kind of a first in the nation, on demand, up and down, in and out process of gas for that facility to meet the wind and help support renewables. Another question we have is we actually are in the process of looking at changing a lot of the mix in our system. We're very interested in renewable natural gas, which under the legislation would not be in the calculations. But today, that'll start off small and build over time. And so how do you address current use versus future use? We're also looking at what's called power to gas, which would include some hydrogen and some other fuels. So again, we'll just be open to working with you on trying to do so we understand as we go forward what it is we can build and what it is we can invest in. We're still required by law to meet our customers' needs. Thank you.
Thank you. Very good. And that's everybody that I have signed up to give testimony today. So I'm going to close the hearing on House, public hearing on House Bill 3343. With that, committee, we are done with business for the day. I am adjourning. I'm going to do one final thing. Any measures on today's agenda not voted out today are carried over to the next agenda. So we had work sessions carried over. I think we got them all, though. Mm-hmm. So those will appear on tomorrow's agenda. And with that, I'm adjourning the House Committee on Energy and Environment. The House Committee.